Okay, we started a new gathering song last week, which is number 188, Come, Come, Whoever You Are. And let's just sing it through twice. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again come. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again come. The words of UU Minister Christian Schmidt, no matter who or what you are welcome here. Let's be clear. Here we welcome goblins and ghouls, saints and sinners, angels and devils, zombies and werewolves, vampires and witches. We welcome princesses and princes, paupers and farmhands, aliens and astronauts, robots and cyborgs, firefighters and police officers, nurses and doctors, cowboys, cowgirls, cowfolk of all variety. We welcome Superman, Wonder Woman, Black Panther, Batman, Spider-Man, Black Widow, and Thor. Indeed, we welcome both superheroes and superstars. In short, we welcome people, monsters, and all other manners of creatures. Here we welcome you and all of who and what you are. We especially welcome this morning a special guest, our speaker, Rabbi Modi Reber. Reb Modi has served as executive director of Kansas Interfaith Action and its predecessor organization, Kansas Interfaith Power and Light, since March of 2011. A native of New Jersey, he's lived in Kansas since 2007. He's a graduate of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in Wincote, Pennsylvania. A lifelong activist on peace, social justice, and environmental issues, Rep. Modi brings a variety of pulpit, interfaith, and organizational experience to the work of Kansas Interfaith Action. Rep. Modi and his wife Susie live with their three teenage children in Overland Park. So now I'm going to ask you to just take a moment to welcome someone you know and someone you don't recognize. Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about Kansas Interfaith Action, which Reb Modi serves. Until recently, there was no progressive religious voice advocating for issues at the state level. No Conference of Churches, no Interfaith Alliance. None of the groups that I am used to looking for as allies in the challenging realm of Kansas politics. No one to bring a progressive moral voice to issues like environmental justice, the rights of immigrants, sanity in gun laws, and criminal justice reform. So the establishment of the Kansas Interfaith Action changed that and created a means for different religious people to assert that not all religious Kansans support conservative policies. So you can find I thought I had one up here to show you, but anyway, there's a table out there with some brochures and information, and I would encourage you to find ways to support Kansas Interfaith Action, and I'm sure they can use money as well as other things. So there's also a sign-up list if you're interested in learning more about the group. And please note other announcements in your order of service. The big deal is that today is trunk or treat. Following the service, you can have some coffee and then in the Alsop room, and then come down to the lower level parking lot and hang out, and you'll find, I don't know, ghouls and goblins and all kinds of seasonally appropriate stuff, not to mention candy and pizza and who knows what all else. All are invited, whether or not you have a costume, and regardless of your age. The other announcement that I want to highlight is a sad one. Most of you know that Barbara Hacker died this week, and we're used to seeing her here regularly on Sunday mornings, and it's not quite the same without her sitting out there. Her memorial service will be held on Friday, November the 11th at 3 p.m. at the First Congregationalist Church, the First Congregational Church downtown. And just refer to your order of service for other announcements. And I'm going to invite Amy Fowler forward with her children, or maybe just Riley, apparently. And they're going to light the chalice this morning.
In the words of Christian Schmidt, oh, and here's Jocelyn. Let us wake up, not just from the Sunday morning exhaustion, from the wish for a few more minutes in bed. Let us wake up to the world we live in, to its beauty and wonder, and also to its tragedy and pain. We must wake up to this reality. Oh no, it moved. That not all in our world have what we do, or however much or little that is. We must wake up to the idea that our wholeness, our lives, are only as complete as the lives of those around us, of those we are tied to in the great web of mutuality, of which all of us are a part. We must hashtag stay woke, in the words of our friends and colleagues involved in the Black Lives Matter, working every day for racial justice in our country. Let us wake up. Let us stay awake. Let us hashtag stay woke.
Our hymn is number 146, Soon the Day Will Arrive, Rise in Body or Spirit.
Thank you.
This week marks our final week on the theme of healing. We've been considering and living into what it means to be a community of healing. One of the ways we strive toward being healing community is to share our lives with one another, to invite others to sympathize with us and rejoice with us. So if you have a significant joy or sorrow in your life to share this morning, please raise your hand and wait for the mic so everyone can hear you and sympathize or rejoice with you, weaving the community of healing.
Michael, O Father, I rise to speak in behalf of ecumenism. The little struggling Baptist church just outside of Stone Valley, or not Stone Valley, but Timber Creek, had a sign on its, had these words on its sign as I drove by there a couple of days ago. Come for trick or trunk to our group next Sunday. Pardon me? Trunk or treat, sorry about that. So there is some hope, perhaps.
Sabrina Boker, I did the mammogram, and it turned out good, so I don't have to worry about it. Yeah.
I have a sorrow and a joy. This is Marissa Larson. A couple weeks ago, my uncle, my mom's younger brother, passed away after his long battle with esophageal cancer, and we have his funeral this coming Thursday. But then also yesterday, I had the joy of getting to reconnect with some college friends I hadn't seen in 23 years. So.
I think Riley wanted me to raise my hand to tell everyone that he turned 8 on Thursday.
Shirley Holbrook, we might just keep Dick Cattell in mind. He went to the hospital last week with pneumonia, and I think he's back home now, is he? Okay. But we might just send a little card or something.
I'm Kathleen Oldfather, and I would just like to thank everyone that helped yesterday with the memorial service for Jack Warren. Many people brought cookies and bars and helped set up and take down and did the dishes. And it was a lovely service, and John Alou did a beautiful job leading it. And just appreciate everybody's participation, and the singers too.
I'm Nancy Stone. I'm a visitor from New Hampshire. I graduated from Kansas State 50 years ago, and I'm pretty sure there was not a Unitarian Fellowship when I was in school, was there? Well, it missed me. I was at the Methodist Church. But I am very joyful for the reunion that I had yesterday and for knowing that you all are here. And will think of you when I'm back in a little fellowship in New Hampshire.
We hold in our hearts all the joys and sorrows, expressed and unexpressed. So whatever you are going through, we are here for you as your community. And as Arthur was prompting us, it's time for the children to come up for the story. And we're going to have some pictures up here behind you, so so you might want to sit so you can look up and see the pictures. Like maybe not right against the wall there. Can you see? Okay. So we're talking about, I want to talk a little bit about the past. power of peace, I want to talk about some important people who we have seen through the years. And I want to talk about two big words. One is nonviolence. Go ahead and turn to the next slide. And one is civil disobedience. So there we are. Nonviolence and civil disobedience. Okay, those are kind of hard. So say it with me. Nonviolence.
Nonviolence.
Okay. What is nonviolence? Yeah?
No violence. No
violence. Okay, so what is violence? Okay, it's stuff we little kids shouldn't know. What? Hurting people. Hurting people. So nonviolence means not hurting. Next slide. Not causing any harm. Okay, now this other word, civil disobedience, that's even bigger. Say that one, civil disobedience.
Civil disobedience.
Civil disobedience. Do any of you know what civil disobedience is? Okay, let's start here. What is obey? Follow the rules. Obey is follow the rules. So what's disobey? Don't follow the rules. Anybody know what civil disobedience is? Yeah?
I'm guessing in this one it has to do with like singling out a group of people.
Okay, when it has to do with singling out a group of people?
Breaking the law.
Yes, let's look at the next slide. Refusing to go along with a law that is wrong. Sometimes the law is wrong. And sometimes people decide to go against it. Next slide. So here's a guy. Anybody heard of Henry David Thoreau?
No.
No? Any of you all heard of Henry David Thoreau? Okay. What do you think of when you think of him? Walden. Okay. He lived out in the woods for a couple of years and wrote a book and so that's why people remember him. But there's another really important thing about Thoreau, because he was opposed to slavery. He did not like slavery. He thought it was wrong. He was right about that. And he was opposed to the war with Mexico. And his taxes were going to the government, so he decided not to pay his taxes. So what do you think happened? He got arrested. Next slide. He went to jail for not paying his taxes. And when he went to jail, he wrote an essay called Civil Disobedience about not following laws when they're wrong. So, next slide. All the way from Massachusetts over to India. We're going to move all the way to India. Next one. Anybody know who this is? Yes?
Well, I know who he is. I'm not sure what he did.
Okay. He's Mahatma Gandhi. And he read Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience many years later. And he decided that India at that time was occupied by the British, and they had a tax on salt. Can you imagine that? A tax on salt? And Gandhi decided that what they would do instead of paying this tax on salt was to march to the sea, next slide, and make salt out of the seawater, which was a traditional practice that they had in India. So they marched to the sea and made salt out of the seawater. And that was their form of what?
Civil disobedience.
That's right. Okay, and next one. I bet a lot of you recognize this guy. Yes, that's Martin Luther King. And he did a lot with civil disobedience. Let's see the next slide. African-American people didn't have the right to vote in many places, like Alabama. And he had a march all the way from Selma to Montgomery to the state capitol, and they just took over the streets. Civil disobedience. and marched to the street to demand the right to vote. And they got it. Yes. Oh, okay. So you know about Alabama. Mm-hmm. And so the tradition of civil disobedience continues even to this day. Right now, there are people in a place called Cannonball, North Dakota, Standing Rock, who are water protectors, who are standing in civil disobedience against having a pipeline go through that could ruin their water. And so the Native American people there, they have this sign up, "Injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere." And do you know who said that? Martin Luther King said that. So that tradition of civil disobedience continues today and has informed many people in many places through the years. And that's what I wanted to share with you this morning. So you can go to your classes.
Shine your light in all you do.
Our fellowship community is a safe haven for growth and dialogue and even healing. And it is a bold model of love, compassion, social action, and justice for ourselves, our society, and our planet. To grow into the full, visible beacon of religious messages of hope and meaning that we strive to be, we are self-supporting. So we have the ritual of passing the plates, an opportunity to give of what we have to support the enactment of our values. The offering will be given and received. Thank you, Matthew. I invite you to join me in a responsive reading. If you look in your hymnal at the back, number 584, these are some words from Martin Luther King that are a reminder that continues to be important to this day. So if you'll read the part that's in italics. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. There are some things in our social system to which all of us ought to be maladjusted. We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. Before it is too late, we must narrow the gaping chasm between our proclamations of peace and our lowly deeds, which precipitate and perpetuate war.
One day we must come to see that peace is not merely a physical world, but we see.
We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means. Our hymn is number 83, Winds Be Still, Rise in Body or Spirit.
Good morning. Thank you for, John Alou for inviting me. Thank you for hearing me. Pleasure to be back in Manhattan, and I've been in this room before. I haven't visited this worship service before, but I was in this space for the MAPJ dinner last year, so any of you who were there might have seen me then. So I wanted to start off by explaining how a rabbi from New Jersey came to be standing at a UU church in Manhattan, Kansas, talking about social justice. So it's kind of a long story. I grew up being committed to social justice. The first demonstration I ever went to was the day that draft registration came on. So those of you who are of a certain vintage will remember that. I was at the New York Post Office. Nuclear power, the nuclear freeze movement, CISPIS and El Salvador. I mean, it just goes on and on. I had a spiritual need when I was in my 20s, and I ended up starting. I started a process that ended up taking me to seminary, and I was glad that my denomination, very similar to Unitarian Universalism, does not ask us to put our conscience at the door as we deal with our theological spiritual questions. Reconstructionist Judaism is very committed to making a difference in the world, a positive difference in the world. So that was a good fit for me. So I've been a rabbi since 2004, and I bounced around quite a bit. I moved to Wichita. I was in Wichita for 3 years, starting from 07. And during that time, an organization called Kansas Interfaith Power and Light was formed in Kansas. And that was a climate change organization trying to develop a faith response to the issue of climate change. And I was asked to be on the board because the person who was the executive director at that point was at a conference in Washington and met one of my colleagues and said, well, if you're talking about climate change in Kansas, you should go talk to Moti. So I ended up on the board. That was from 7 to 10. And then in 11, the job came open and I became the director. So I served as director of Interfaith Power and Light from 11 up until the end of 15. What happened in 15 was a couple of things happened. One was that we had to reincorporate because our fiscal sponsor was having financial troubles, so we had to sort of bail on that. And it led to a discernment process for us where we thought about what kind of organization we wanted to be. It was a real fork in the road. And as John Liu mentioned, we were well aware that there was not a faith voice, faith and conscience voice from the moderate to progressive side of things in Kansas. The right wing is very well represented in their religiosity, but there wasn't really an organized voice coming from the center left to left side. In other states, there are National Council of Churches and ministerial alliances of various kinds. And in Texas, it's called Texas Impact. It's a public policy organization that organizes in faith communities. So we didn't have anything like that in Kansas, which is a real gap. So since I had spent the last 5 years going around the state and talking to pastors and congregations about climate change, we thought we were in a good situation to fill that gap or try to fill that gap. So on January 1st of 2016, we announced and rolled out as Kansas Interfaith Action. So that's what we've been doing this year. And when we started to think about our mission and what kind of organization we wanted to be, we started by connecting to a person who was mentioned in the talk, who's unquestionably one of the greatest Americans that we've ever seen, which is Martin Luther King. And we tend to look at him as a figure from the dim and distant past who we roll out every January, for a brief snippet of a powerful speech at the Lincoln Memorial, and then we forget about it. But he was a man who had a deep, radical analysis of the issues facing this country, and also a means to address them. And many of the issues that he was talking about are still the issues for us today. It's integration or legalized racism is de jure racism is. We've come a long way in that regard, but there's still a lot of problems that this country faces that he dealt with in his analysis, and it behooves us to go back and sort of look at that a little bit and take our place as his heirs and inheritors. So he had what he called the three evils. It's from the speech that he gave at Riverside Church. The three evils are poverty, racism, and violence. And those are still the three evils that beset us today. And people of faith and conscience have the responsibility, to take the lead in addressing them, not simply ameliorating them, but digging them out, digging to their root causes, addressing their root causes. And each of these evils, so this is our mission statement, and each of these evils had a, we worked on an issue in 2016 on this, on this. So about poverty, I'm going to give you a couple quotes. On poverty, King said, "There's nothing new about poverty. What is new, however, is that we now have the resources to get rid of it. The time has come for an all-out world war against poverty. The well-off and the secure have too often been indifferent and oblivious to the poverty and deprivation in their midst. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. No individual or nation can be great if it does not have a concern for the least of these." And this is an area where I think we're going backwards. As the minimum wage stays stagnant for years and the poor are vilified, Dr. King called for a war of poverty, and for a while there was one, and it did work. But in our time, the social safety net is a tattered remnant. And this is also an area where our mad scientist governor felt that they had the right answers. So this year particularly saw an expansion of what was called the HOPE Act, or the very ironically called HOPE Act, which is a welfare reform bill. At the time, initially, it famously prevented people who were getting cash aid from taking cruises or going to nail salons. You may have heard that, sort of playing into the stereotypes that people have or that certain people have about the poor. Initially, it also limited ATM withdrawals to $25, which would have guaranteed that unbanked clients would spend a large percentage of their limited means in fees. There's all kinds of problems with this bill, and I can sort of go into it in more detail. The extension was in 2016, and we testified against this bill on the Health and Human Services Committee. And I like this one because I had a theological discussion with one of the representatives who got his back up when I said that the legislation was mean-spirited. And he asked me how I would pay for a more generous welfare system, and I said you could start by fixing the tax code that you broke. You know, another way is to raise the minimum wage is a big way to address poverty. You know, forcing people off of welfare into minimum wage jobs with no job training and no child care is not a means out of poverty. You know, there's lots of things that we could do that would address poverty if that was really our goal. But it's really not. And in a ranking by the so the irony of this is a perverse incentive. When they made the welfare reform bill in Washington, they gave block grants to the states, but they didn't put any requirements on how the states are supposed to spend it. So the states get a bunch of money. If they artificially suppress the roles, the welfare roles, then they can use that money for other things, which there's a lot of other things that need to be funded nowadays in Kansas. So it's that's the real reason why they're suppressing the welfare rolls. In a ranking by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, Kansas fell to 19th from 15th. In a ranking of well-being of children in the 50 states, that's the second largest drop of any state. What this shows is that policy choices that we make have negatively impacted, that we have made have negatively impacted the well-being of children in our state. And in this category, I also include access to affordable health care. There are between 135 and 150,000 Kansans who are in the gap between Medicaid as it exists now and Obamacare. That's the Medicaid expansion that the governor and the legislature won't talk about. KIFA is part of a broad, KIFA is the Kansas Interfaith Action, so now you have the code. KIFA is part of a broad alliance of organizations that will make this a high priority in the new session. And we have reason to believe that we can be successful with the outcome of the primaries as they were, and hopefully November will be similar. About racism, Dr. King said, "Racism is a philosophy based on a contempt of life, contempt for life. It is the arrogant assertion that one race is the center of value and the object of devotion before which other races must kneel in submission. It is the absurd dogma that one race is responsible for all the progress of history and alone can assure the progress of the future. Racism is total estrangement. It separates not only bodies, but minds and spirits. Inevitably, it descends to inflicting spiritual and physical homicide upon the outgroup." Recent events have shown us, those of us with the good fortune of being able to ignore such things, that this is an issue that has not gone away. From the circumscribed opportunities from people of color to the militarized policing in majority black neighborhoods to the huge percentage of African Americans, particularly young African American males, who are in the prison system, and has become blindingly apparent in the past couple of years, brought to national attention by the Black Lives Matter movement, the incidents of violence between black people and the police. To this list, we can add armed militants being acquitted while peaceful Native American protesters protecting their sacred lands are maced and beaten. What white progressives need to learn is that there's no social justice and there's no economic justice without racial justice. And since the sin is ours, the responsibility for repentance and reparation is ours as well. Meanwhile, a man is running for president basically on a platform of white resentment. And in our own state, the family of the president of Bethany College has been subjected to racist graffiti and threats. I don't know if you saw that in the news. And a conspiracy to kill an entire community of Somali immigrants took place in Dodge City. People of faith and conscience believe that all people, are created in the image of God. Forgive me for using the G word, but I'm a theist. And we need to stand up for that principle 100%. You can put it in inverted commas if it makes you more comfortable. God. To this category, we can add the multitude of prejudices that beset our society today: sexism, homophobia, prejudice against those with unresolved immigration status, and particularly Islamophobia, which is being spoken increasingly among people who desire to be political leaders. Kansas Interfaith Action believes that everyone deserves the right to respect and dignity, to equal opportunity, and to equal treatment under the law. In particular, the anti-Muslim prejudices we see today remind me of what was faced 80 or 100 years ago by those from Southern and Eastern Europe. The no Irish need apply signs, the hospitals and hotels that were off limits to Jews. It's very similar language. They can't integrate. Their values don't jive with American values. That's almost the same language. And to me, the opposition to refugees from war-torn areas is particularly disturbing. It's worthwhile to point out that it's our actions in the Middle East that led rise to these refugees. So our refusal to give comfort to its victims is particularly troubling, and I would say unchristian. That leads us to for people who purport to be Christians in their policy decisions, and that leads us to Dr. King's third evil, which is violence and war. About this, he said, "A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This way of burning human beings with napalm, and maybe we could replace that with drones, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of people normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged," is this any different today, "cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." Is any of this different today? We are a society that has more or less agreed that the Iraq War was a mistake, but whenever a new threat is perceived, the immediate instinct is to address it by military means. We never really process or absorb our mistakes. We just forget about them and move on. That's what happened with Vietnam. President Obama pointed out in his State of the Union address earlier this year that the United States spends as much on its military as the next 8 nations combined. He meant this to be a positive thing, to address the fear-mongering among Republican presidential candidates, but I, for one, don't find it a number to be particularly proud of. That money could be better used fixing our roads and bridges, educating and feeding our children, and building a clean energy future. And so without, so within. We live in a society racked with fear of each other and armed to the teeth. Anyone without a criminal record, and some with, can carry any weapon they want, anywhere they want, without training or permit or consideration for those of us who don't want to live in such a society. And as the statistics clearly show, the good guy with a gun myth is just that, it's a myth, and the weapons are far more likely to be used for domestic violence or suicide than for self or home protection. Kansas has the laxest gun laws in the country, and to this we are about to add the ability to carry concealed firearms without training or permit on our college campuses, on our public college campuses. I've been told many times since I've been in Kansas not to bother taking up the issue of guns, but I'm a nonviolence activist, and it seems to me that there's nothing less nonviolent than the idea of carrying a gun on a college campus. So we're working on this statewide, and I encourage you to get involved in that. There's information on the table out there about our sub-organization, Kansans Against Campus Carry. We're trying to link together the groups that are working on this. And I have spoken at K-State before, and some of the professors have met with me. Some students are working on it, so there's a little bit of action going on focused on the session, and I'm happy to answer questions about that when we get to that point. And if you'll forgive me, to Dr. King's three evils, I add a fourth, which is environmental degradation, particularly climate change. This came to awareness after his death, but I feel pretty sure that he'd forgive me for including it. Lest we forget, in the face of what seem to be more immediately apparent issues, the way we are powering our society is causing changes in the very chemistry of our atmosphere with repercussions that we're not even aware of yet. So to go along with the four mission pieces, which I just gave you, I'm going to propose four values by which we can approach this work. The first value, I would say, is interdependence, or what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. The recognition that we're all linked. We're linked to each other. We're linked to the earth. It's actually been taught by spiritual leaders, great spiritual leaders, throughout the centuries. There's no separation. The Cartesian, which means that the Cartesian separation of mind and body, or the Christian separation between soul and the physical body, or between mankind and the rest of creation, are actually misunderstandings and damaging misunderstandings. All of creation, all of everything, is a unity. In the words of Thich Nhat Hanh, we inter-are. This realization, fully taken in, cannot help but affect the way we react and interact with the world. And the implication of that is that there's more to life than economics. Because we are spiritual beings, we can never be fully satisfied with material things, which is good because the way we're living is killing our ability to live on this planet. For too long, we've treated each other and the planet as useful only for our own personal advancement, economic advancement. And that way of living has reached the end of its useful life, if it ever had one. Unless we develop a way to live that is not so injurious to nature and to other people, we won't have our civilization around for very much longer. That might seem dramatic, but if you look at the issues about climate change, it's not unrealistic. The second value is principled strategic use of nonviolence. So I want to quibble a tiny bit with the definition of nonviolence that you promulgated before. Nonviolence is not just passivism. It's a strategic force of organization that can be brought to bear in struggle. Right? Organization and the use of a force more powerful, right, to use the name of that movie. For Dr. King, nonviolence was not simply a strategy which can be disposed of when circumstances arise, but the very cause itself, the only acceptable means to the end. Taking from Gandhi, King saw the end of the struggle not as the defeat of the other, but as reconciliation. We oppose systems, he said. We oppose evils, but we do not oppose persons who are usually also victimized by the evils they represent. Nonviolence must be our path as well. Nonviolence meaning not relying on the gun to protect us, but to build a world where justice and peace prevail. Nonviolence in the images that we put into our minds and the words that come out of our mouths. How many people watch Walking Dead? Right? So last week's show, right? I mean, it's an image that you can't get out of your mind. So, I mean, that's what we put into our minds on a daily basis. We also are propagandized to believe that the only way that a challenging situation can be resolved is by the death of the antagonist. Right? That's the way every show ends. Every movie ends is with the death of the antagonist. There's no solution, there's no resolution other than that. I want to emphasize this last point. I realized at the end of the session in 2015, it was a very difficult session, and many of the things that we and other people had been working on for years were destroyed, basically. I found myself becoming hateful of some of the people I was working with in Topeka. Hateful of what was being done to our state and the people who were doing it. And that's a very common feeling, as we see in this campaign and in the language that's used on the internet in our public discourse. So that leads me to the next value, which I've kind of gone back and forth about how to frame this. Dr. King called it love, and spoke movingly about responding to hatred, about responding to the hatred coming from the police with love. I'm not entirely comfortable calling it love, although I understand it as an aspiration. It sounds a little too Christian to my Jewish ears. I've had people come up to me after I've given this sermon and say, how am I supposed to love Donald Trump? Which is a question I have not been able to come to an answer about. Okay, let's find another language. In Buddhism, it's called compassion, right? If I try really hard and I'm in a very good space, I can probably work up some compassion for Donald Trump. His father probably wasn't very nice. But that's a lot of work, and it seems limited to the meta. Sam Brownback's another one. You know, he truly believes what he believes, and it's all falling apart. And he won't acknowledge that it's falling apart, but it must be very difficult for him to see everything he's always believed collapse, which, you know, I could have told him in 2011 it was going to collapse. But so now I've decided to call it non-hatred. So I think that's something we can accomplish. All right, so when you think of Trump or Sam Brownback or Charles Koch, I think you will agree with me, if you think about it, that hatred is a useless emotion. I have a friend who likens it to holding a bee in your hand. Right? It doesn't do anybody any good. It doesn't only hurts you. But let's even go beyond the famous reprobates. How much we objectify the other. Human beings have an innate tendency to pick sides, to valorize us and to vilify them. Religious people do it too, of course, which is directly what I believe is the instruction within all faith traditions to broaden the circle of care and concern, to open up our hearts to others. In the Torah, it's called love the stranger, for you were strangers. From the Torah's instruction to love the stranger, for you were strangers, to Jesus' words, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy, to similar instructions from all the great teachers, from Buddha to Gandhi to King, we are taught to look at the other with compassion, or for us unexalted people, with non-hatred. And finally, fourth and finally, hope. Hope. On a weekend like this, it's a bad weekend. We have the image of militarized police tear gassing natives, protecting their water. On one page, while on the other page, we have this acquittal of these violent militia members. It's beyond irony. I don't know what the word is beyond irony, but it's like irony to the 10th power. So on a weekend like this, hope seems like it's a very difficult thing to access, but we must. Hope is the belief that if we act with organization, with discipline, with care and concern, that we can make a difference for the better. And we've seen that it's true. Here's a quote from David Henderson that I found on the internet. Optimism claims everything will be all right despite reality. So it's hope as opposed to optimism. Optimism is kind of blind, you know. But hope, optimism claims everything will be all right before, despite reality. Hope accepts reality, the poverty of spirit that underlies all fear and instigates all tragedies. But hope has a trump card, the capacity of the human heart. When optimism gets ground up by reality, hope will go toe-to-toe with reality because of a heart that simply refuses to quit. A heart that simply refuses to quit. So we do this by putting these four values into action by, as Dr. King put it, building the beloved community. I thought about this a lot, and I think the most important word in interfaith action is interfaith. There's a vital humility that comes with the realization that none of us and none of our traditions is the sole holder of truth. By working together, we move past what divides us in pursuit of what unites us. Moving past our separateness as individuals and as faith traditions, working together for the sake of harmony, for the sake of justice, for the sake of helping those in need, for the sake of bringing peace. It is only when we come together with those beyond our immediate circles that are reaching the heights that God wants us to go. Kansas Interfaith Action is meant to fill a need, a lack in our state's political culture. Our goal is to build the beloved community of dedicated people of faith, of all traditions and of no traditions, to stand up to the four evils of violence, poverty, racism, and environmental destruction. It is thus that our compassion, our personal spiritual work, and our deepest values will have their greatest impact in the public square. And perhaps, just perhaps, if we truly come together in this godly effort, we will build a world where each of us, rich and poor, black or white, straight or gay, Muslim, Christian, Universalist, Unitarian, Buddhist, atheist, or Jew, each of us can have our own vine and our own fig tree, and there will be none to make us afraid. Thank you very much. And now we have a few minutes for discussion, questions and discussion. Wait for the mic.
Good morning, and thanks very much for coming. My question is about your organization and Interfaith and the tensions that you may feel between different faiths and their beliefs. You're all-encompassing, and all of us in this room, I think, can get behind probably 100% or pretty close to it, what you said, but visiting any other many other churches, especially in Manhattan and elsewhere, there would be a tension in the room after saying some of those words. And I'm wondering how your organization deals with that, and do you allow certain faiths to opt out of?
Well, I mean, it's all a matter of opting in, really. Yeah. It's a real big issue. We do very well with the Unitarians. I mean, obviously, I know every Unitarian minister in Kansas. The relative. That's relative. I can count them on fingers of one hand. We do very well with UCC churches for the similar reasons. We do very well with sort of liberal Methodists. Methodist is a very broad category. And they also have a Big Ten philosophy. So a lot of times I won't do the sermon, I'll do a teaching, like I'll do the speech or I'll do a PowerPoint presentation in their adult education. I discovered long ago that it isn't really necessary for me to recruit churches. What's necessary is for me to recruit people. So if I can get into the church and recruit some people, that's what I want to do. Because a lot of the goal of this is power for advocacy. And the way that you develop power is by recruiting people. Now the pastors, pastors may or may not get involved because pastors are risk averse, most of them. Not Unitarian Universalists, of course, but speaking of Methodists, for instance, they're risk averse. They don't want to peeve the donor or the few people that they have left or whatever. I happen to think that's counterproductive because if you just try to be non-controversial, you'll end up losing the people who actually want to stand for something. That's an easy thing for me to say because I don't have a pulpit. So I talk to ministerial alliances, and then of course the people that I call evangelicals, which I don't know what they call themselves, but are completely in a different category because they're completely separated. They don't join ministerial alliances. They don't do ecumenism. So sometimes it comes up, sometimes things come up that we can work on together. Sometimes around environmental issues and sometimes on the refugee issue there was some play. It kind of depends on the issue. So my goal is to just make sure that most people know about this and try to recruit the people that are most interested in it. And I can argue with people about climate change and stuff. I've been doing it for years, and other stuff like that. And the other thing is that, from my point of view, a lot of times when I testify, what I'm doing is going to the United Methodist Public Policy website or the Presbyterian or the UU Public Policy website and just writing down what they say. you know, and here's what UU says about this, and here's what UM says about this, and here's what the Jewish community says about this. And I don't want to get into, I'm not going to argue with you about Scripture, because you know, all God's children have interpretations of Scripture, but the people who were paid to interpret Scripture for public policy purposes say this, you know. And that's also helpful, because I can say, I know you, Senator whatever, identify as a Methodist. Well, here's what your church says. So sometimes they believe that, and some, you know, it doesn't always cause action, but at least it causes a moment of thinking. So, I mean, I know I'm preaching to the converted here, you know, which the converted need preachers too. I mean, you know, preaching to the choir, right? So the choir needs to be, you know, you need to know that there are people working on this, because otherwise it feels very hopeless. So I want to tell you that there are people working on this. You know, we have a database of over 2,000 people. We have every reason to think that CanCare will be expanded next year. We have every reason to think that it's possible that campus carry could be delayed or repealed or whatever. I don't know. You know, it depends on the election. But if you stand there and you go, well, this is Kansas, you can't do anything about it, then you've self-fulfilled your prophecy. So I'm here to tell you that, you know, we're doing this, and people are responding to it, and it's very possible that we can succeed. That's the best I can do. Let me get my water.
I've been reading for many weeks now a book I got from the library, The Militant King, and it's a compilation by Cornell West of the writings of Martin Luther King.
Uh-huh.
And my head is absolutely filled with it. And so you've articulated a lot of the ideas that came from his writings. And so I didn't realize what an absolute genius and charismatic and poetic person he was. And just what a sacrilege it is to have Martin Luther King Day. I mean, it's just so pathetic. Right. But
Look, the society or the dominant paradigm depends on neutering challenging figures. You know, so he gets killed, and then he gets, you know, limited to whatever he's limited to, right? And all the rest of it just goes away.
That, right. So, he was nicied up, and he right. was considered the
same
most
thing happened with Muhammad Ali this year.
Oh yeah, and Malcolm X. So my husband and I, both been reading Malcolm X's autobiography too.
Right.
The same thing. They were considered. They were so charismatic, they were considered the most dangerous people in the country.
Right.
Anyway, but what I've realized is how important expression is and learning words to express these ideas. And I like that Martin Luther King enumerates, like you said, these three things, and you added on social justice, poverty, racism, and
violence.
Military violence.
And I added on climate change.
Right, and climate change. So I think that you said that the interfaith group, you've picked some things, some actions to go with those. And so is that what you said?
Well, also, I mean, what happens is issues come up. To some degree, this work is reactive, because I didn't know that they're going to do an expansion of the HOPE Act last year. You know, I find out that they do. It's within my mission statement, so I go and work on it. That's how it works, basically. I mean, I have some positive things now that we're having for the last 5 years, as a climate change activist and then as a more general social justice activist, I've been playing defense, you know, putting a ever smaller number of fingers into an ever expanding number of holes in the dike, you know, and just trying to stop bad things from happening. You know, now we're in a position where, I mean, with the elections, it kind of depends, but also the state is bankrupt, so there's a little bit of limitation there. But at least we can start talking about positive policy instead of just playing defense all the time.
Okay, I don't want to be a person sitting reading a book.
Right.
So I know I went to a fundraiser for CanCare, and so maybe if I accessed your group, I could find out specific things that could be done. I mean, it's
yes.
so easy to just to spread your frustration
yes.
and not
yes.
take any
yeah,
action.
Yeah, if you're looking for something to do, I can definitely give you something to do.
The thing about, one of the things in your talk that absolutely inspired me was the notion of when you're talking about nonviolence, reconciling or reconciliation with opponents who are in fact themselves victims.
Mm-hmm.
I, I think of the characterization of a lot of Trump supporters. They're victims of the policies that presumably would be enforced in a Trump administration. Have you some suggestions about steps towards reconciling with these victims?
You know, it's a really good question, and I have a language that I've been using about reclaiming the moral voice. You know, for years we've sort of ceded morality to hyper-religious right-wing Christians, and we've almost said we can't even talk about that because they own that language, and that's ridiculous. So we need to reclaim, and, you know, especially now that I believe, I don't know if they believe it, but I believe that their claim to morality has been essentially destroyed by what happened this year. I mean, you can't support, I'm nonpartisan and this is a church, so I can't really say too much about this, but you can't support what they're supporting and claim to be the moral arbiter of what morality is. So, but I also find myself sort of going into they and us language. You know, they say this and we say this, and I don't find that to be helpful, and I haven't quite squared that circle yet. I think right now the best we can do is non-hatred. I think right now the best we can probably do is non-hatred. Let's see where it goes. You know, the Trump thing is really really complicated because it's partially sort of the loss of economic opportunity through neoliberalism, but it's also the loss of white privilege. You know, because every white schmuck in this country was always better than the highest black person. You know, that was what white people could depend on. You know, if you're the town drunk, you're still higher than the black doctor, whatever. That doesn't exist anymore. And that's something that this country was built on. That was what this country was built on white privilege. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on here. They're losing their identity as the rulers of the country. And that's what Trump really represents, is resentment about that. Not even neoliberalism. He benefits from neoliberalism more than anybody. You know, globalization. You know, his ties made in China and all that stuff. He's not talking about that. He's not really accessing that. He's accessing white resentment. So I, you know, right now I think the best we can hope for is non-hatred. I think building connections as much as possible, trying to be less angry, you know, from our point of view, you know, trying to be what they always thought Christians were supposed to be like. You know, they, I said it again. You know, it's hard. It's very hard. It's a, you know, it's a very oppositional dynamic, obviously, as you see in the election. It's very us or them. That's a very hard thing to sort of hold, and it's hard to hold wholeness when you're working on one issue against decidedly opposition who you think is, you know, not standing up for what's right. So it's a very hard question. But it's part of our spiritual work. You know, we're interconnected, we're connected with them, they're connected with us, we're all connected with the earth, we have to represent that. And I think as we go forward, you know, if we keep that in mind and work on ourselves, then that, you know, I hope that it will develop, I don't know.
One more question.
Yeah, you sort of covered this, but the non-hatred part was what I was going to try to expand on and try to understand how. I mean, so I think of non-hatred as trying to sort of analyze your own maybe biases to try and get to the root of those and see how maybe they're similar to the biases of those on the other side. But, you know, yeah, if you could expand on that a little bit, the non-hatred, how do you do that? I mean, what are the ways you do that?
Well, I think I think a lot of it is a personal spiritual practice. You know, I think it's done on the cushion, basically. It's, you know, trying to think about compassion, trying to do your metta practice, your loving kindness, your loving kindness meditation. You know, if you can expand that feeling, then that's how you do it. I mean, hatred is an internal thing. It's not triggered. I mean, it is triggered, but you're not made to feel hatred by other people. It's something that comes out of you. So it comes something that comes out of us. Not you in particular, right? I heard about you. No. So I think working on that internally is really the way to go. Like, you know, I have to say, when I felt hatred towards legislators who I thought were doing harming people, you know, I know that that makes me less effective. You know, notwithstanding the fact that it's got other problems too, it makes me less effective. And it also just isn't the way I want to live my life. So that's something I have to come to terms with. It's not something that their behavior is going to change and that's going to make me not get triggered in that way. It's something that I have to work on. It's completely, so you can actually, you know, non-hatred is really personal spiritual practice. It's trying to develop the ability to be at peace with the world as it is, even as we try to change it. Does that make sense? I mean, we accept things as they are. That's the only means that we have to change it. If we pretend that there's something else, then we're not going to be effective in our action. Clarity and calmness and equanimity is the basis by which we can decide what the next action should be. And hatred complicates that or clouds that and makes us reactive and want to hurt, you know. And that's not an effective means of making social change, in my opinion. And I have thought about this a lot. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, I can. Our closing hymn is number 400, Shalom Havarim.
We'll sing it in unison a couple of times, and then we'll do it at the round. We all play once with us, okay?
Yeah.
Words from Reverend Elaine Aaron Tenbrick. May we choose to give ourselves to the future so that that commitment might make the present inhabitable. May we even dare to find joy in it, which would be the ultimate rebellion. You are my people. We are each other's people. Love will prevail. May it be so.